Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. You know, we live in a virtual Shangri-La right here at the Triad with amazing arts events going on each week in Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and High Point. Plus, if you're willing to broaden your artistic horizons just a bit further, the bounty is practically limitless. First, how about an award-winning Celtic and old-timey fiddling trio that's been performing together since they were 6 years old? They're just one short trip to the beautiful high country of Boone. Then it's a hop, skip, and a jump to Mount Airy and an amazing theatrical tribute to the world's most famous twins. Or imagine enlarging your perspective, informing your writing style, and expanding your impact as a poet all at the North Carolina Zoo. That's right, their poet in residence has a workshop just for you in Asheboro. Original dance with Terpsichore at Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem, a different live outdoor concert at a different gorgeous public park every Sunday through August in Greensboro, and Johann Sebastian Bach like you've never heard him before, with Karoff at the keyboard, all coming up next on Triad Arts Up Close. The Forget-Me-Nots are young fiddlers Willa and Leda Fink and Mara Sean Scanlon. Amazingly, these three teenagers have been performing together for more than a decade. They began in 2002 as a trio of Suzuki All-Stars at the tender ages of 6, 7, and 8 years old. And today the Boone natives are national competition winners with three CDs under their belts. You can hear them live in concert tonight at 5 o'clock during Music on the Lawn at the Jones House at the Watauga Arts Council in Boone. Be sure to bring a blanket or a chair. The following day, Saturday, July 14th, starting at 12:30, the Forget-Me-Nots will be at the Sugar Grove Music Fest with a terrific lineup of bands in an intimate setting. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And in the meantime, here's Leda and Maura Sean. They drop by WFDD shortly after the release of their CD, Blooming. It features all original material, and we'll be sampling from it today. So, Maura Sean and Leda, we've been hearing, sampling a lot of great upbeat tunes from the new CD, Blooming. But you all said you'd like to try a ballad. Tell me about it. Is it your own arrangement?
It's not. It was written by John McGann, a Canadian guitarist, and we learned it from a CD that we've been enjoying for a long time. And it's a waltz. It's called Canyon Moonrise.
It is.
And it's a really pretty tune. We love it. So.
It is our arrangement, though, right?
Yeah.
How does a tune evolve in the hands of the Forget-Me-Nots?
We learned the basic tune off of the CD or wherever we heard it or another fiddler, and then we usually take it home, and after we've played it for several weeks or something, we arrange it. We come up with an arrangement for it.
Sometimes it's just quick, like we learn it. The tunes themselves are generally pretty simple, and then we just pass it around, fool around, get some cool stuff, and then once we all have something we like, we
sit down and
fine-tune it and get it together.
Yeah.
And does that include, hey, let's do a tempo shift here or modulate, change keys?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah. Some of the arrangements are more intricate, I guess, than
out
others.
There.
So they take a little longer, but...
Yeah, I was listening to Blooming Clover Leap Jig. Lots of shifts there. Lots of rhythmic changes in terms of the groove and then quick key change. Really neat.
Yeah.
Lots of fun. Well, let's slow things down a little bit with this waltz. And again, the name of it?
Canyon Moonrise.
And who wrote it initially?
John McGann.
Okay, here we go. We're going to hear Leda and Maura Sean.
Thank you.
So, Morshawn, you've won lots of fiddling competitions. You're the National Scottish Fiddling Champion. What are they like? What do you get out of that experience?
Well, it's a really good experience because you get to hear a lot of other fiddlers in the genre. But I guess the thing that sort of is interesting about the competitions is that there's competitions in all of the different styles of fiddling. So there's like old-time competitions, and then there's Scottish competitions, and there's Irish competitions, and there's bluegrass competitions, and there's like Texas-style competitions. And I think that's something that the band sort of is combining a lot of those styles. And it's interesting because when you do the competitions, you have to stay away from all the other styles except for just the one that you're competing in. But our band blends this, all the styles together.
You did well at the old-timey convention, too, in 2009 up in Boone area. What's the similarity? We talk about old-timey and Scottish fiddling.
They're all derived from the same. So the Scots, originally, when they emigrated to America, and then they trickled down into the South, and the music just gradually changed over all the years.
And evolved throughout the regions.
Yeah, and so now there's all these different little enclaves of, like, old-time music. But then the tunes, some of the tune names are, like, the same. Like, you'll hear a Scottish tune that has the same name as an old-time tune, and it's
completely different.
They're completely different. And and even sometimes, like, they're similar tunes, and you can, like, play them on top of each other.
Do float back and forth between those two styles fairly comfortably, talking about old time and Scottish and Irish. Not a big deal for you. And Lita, you're floating back and forth between not only classical and Irish music and Celtic music, but cello, flute, piano, all these different instruments.
You double.
Talk about your doubler's fees. That's really unusual to play that variety of instruments. And what does it give you? How do those various instruments help you just musically as an overall musician?
We haven't done much integrating of non-violin instruments into the band so far. I don't know, it's difficult to kind of step out of our normal arrangements, but we've always wanted to bring in the new things. I mean, I love playing multiple instruments, completely different technique and tone, and like there's a rainbow of possibilities. So even if it's not directly applied to Celtic music, it just opens your mind up to a new array of sounds.
Yeah.
I saw on YouTube that little concert, I guess it was in the Jones House in Boone saw.
Yeah.
I caught several selections. The first, Catch the Light, which was a nice tune. I liked the arrangement of that because it starts off kind of, you know, with the pizzicato and kind of little shimmers of light. How did that come about, that arrangement?
Well, we actually got to work with a fiddle friend, mentor of ours named Jamie Laval.
He helped us out with
who lived in Asheville at the time, I think. But he helped us out with the arrangements of a few tracks, and that was one of them.
Neat build on that tune.
Yeah.
Let's check it out. Tune for June, I love those, really in contrast to that, at least the contrast at the beginning, that kind of amorphous beginning, kind of the cloud-like thing with the light shining. Yeah. And then you get this really driving fiddle tune, which I kind of thought of Tune for June as. I love that. And then we talked about those sudden shifts. Are those hard to get together when you suddenly change, you either modulate or you change your rhythmic groove?
They are, but I think it comes easier for us maybe than it would to other people just because we've been playing together for so long that we basically know what to expect at all times from each other.
The main problem that we actually have a lot of problems with is fiddle tunes are generally written in an AABB format where you have two parts which are each repeated twice, and sometimes it's pretty repetitive, so you end up playing it like AAAB or something.
We get a little confused sometimes.
Have you done that in concert where suddenly you've
created?
Yeah.
Yes, that happens all the time.
Frequently.
But
luckily, usually one of us is playing the right thing, so we all get back on track.
There's a little moment that we're like, we're good.
Yeah, I guess that's the advantage of playing together since you're three or four.
Yeah.
My thanks to fiddlers Maura Sean Scanlon and Leda Fink. Together with Willa Fink, they form the band The Forget-Me-Nots. We've been sampling from their new CD of original material throughout the show. It's titled Blooming, and if you like what you heard, you'll find links to where you can own a copy on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You can hear the Forget-Me-Nots live in concert tonight at 5 o'clock during Music on the Lawn at the Jones House at the Watauga Arts Council in Boone. And on Saturday, starting at 12:30, they'll perform at the Sugar Grove Music Fest. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Today we're plumbing the Triad outskirts for arts and coming up big winners. First with great music, and next with a fantastic piece of theater that resonates powerfully with local, national, and international audiences alike. It's the Surrey Arts Council's wonderful 15th annual production of Burton Cohen's play, The Wedding of the Siamese Twins. It opens Saturday, July 21st at 3 o'clock at the historic Earle Theater in downtown Mount Airy, and it'll run through Friday, July 27th. The wedding celebrates the lives of the world-famous twins and former Mount Airy residents Ang and Chang Bunker. Born in 1811, brought to the States at 18 and exhibited throughout the world for years, the two brothers, co-joined at the chest, declared their independence and settled down in Wilkes County. It was there they met and married sisters Sarah and Adelaide Yates and became prosperous citizens of the community, where they raised 21 children between them. The Wedding of the Siamese Twins is being presented in conjunction with the annual Bunker Family Reunion. Hundreds of descendants still live in the area, with hundreds more spread out across the country and around the world. Actors Greg Matthews, who plays Chang, and Scott Carpenter, who plays Ang, stopped by WFDD to talk about their challenging roles, along with director Stan Bernstein.
The thing that's amazing to me, still, is how many people, even people here in our area, who don't realize that the original Siamese twins, who traveled with P.T. Barnum and went all over the world and were at one point the most famous people in the world, lived most of their lives right here in the Triad, just outside of Mount Airy. And their descendants are still all through Wilkes and Surrey County. And of course, Mount Airy gets hundreds of thousands of visitors every year for, because it's Mayberry. But when they get here, they find that just behind Andy Griffith is the Siamese twins, which were part of our history. As a matter of fact, if anybody's traveling at the Arts Council building, which is right next to the Andy Griffith Playhouse, there's a whole room dedicated to the Siamese twins and their history and their importance in the area. So it's fascinating stuff.
Let's talk about some of that history, too, because by the time they arrived here to the Piedmont Triad, they were already world famous, something I didn't realize. And then going back through the archives, let's go back, I guess, over 100 years now. How far?
They came in the 1830s.
Going back to this idea of really being able to simply decide to get out of their contract, because initially they were exhibited, correct?
That's correct. They traveled all over the world for an American sea captain named Coffin, who brought them to the United States, and they traveled all around. And they waited till their contract was over, and then made a decision that they just were tired of traveling, as successful as they were and as world famous as they were. They decided they just really wanted to take it easy and have a private life. And a lot of people were concerned that because they were uneducated and they did come from Siam, that they might be taken advantage of. And all indications seem to prove that they weren't. They got exactly what they were promised, their percentage. Captain Coffin was very, very meticulous about that. And they were protected. They had some good friends when they lived in New York who were always kind of looking out for them and making sure that they got what they had been promised. And in their travels, they had met a doctor from the Mount Airy area. And he had told them, he's from Wilkes County, said how wonderful it was. And back in the 1830s, it really was incredibly rural. And they had been to all these great big cities, but this was just pastoral and calm. One of the reasons why they loved North Carolina was they weren't on display and they weren't oddities. North Carolina, the folks around here were willing to just accept them for who they were, and they were just guys who were always together, and that was it. They decided to buy a farm because they had a lot of money. They were very wealthy at that time. Buy a farm and settle here, and they did. They stayed until their death.
It's pretty remarkable when you think of the level of acceptance that I'm getting actually occurred back then. We're talking the 1800s, and it seemed like they just settled right in. Was it that simple from your recollection, your family's recollection?
Well, from what I understand, they actually got more trouble about being Asian or Oriental, as they would have said at the time, than they did about the band joining them together.
The title of the play is The Wedding of the Siamese Twins. So the focus of the play is about their life after they have traveled the world and about their relationship with their wives, these sisters from the area who became their wives, and their families. And another thing that always stops people in their tracks is when they hear that the Bunkers between them had 21 children.
One thing that I really enjoy about this play is it looks at both the comforts of being very close to someone and the frustrations of being very close to someone. Now, I'm using very close to someone in a very literal sense in this show, but even in our characters, it's clear that one brother is more comfortable being close, whereas the other one has a constant desire to be independent.
Was Aang the one who wanted to be more independent?
No. Aang, he's not as uncomfortable being a twin. Chang is a more, I think, independent, assertive person. He's more excited about getting married. Aang is kind of always thinking it through. And there's a good analogy that we have where we're playing chess. And Aang's character is very thoughtful about each piece. And Chang's like, move, let's go, let's go, let's go. You're always holding back, let's go.
Whenever it comes to Chang's turn, it's like, check, you know, and that's all the thought he puts into it. It's like a second, it's check.
The yin and yang within Chang and, no, Chang and Aang.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
There
you go. That relationship must have somehow been attractive to your betrothed because they were comfortable with that. I would imagine it would have been an intimidating thing for a young woman to come across, and yet it works out very well for you both.
It seems like there is a sort of mirror image in the sisters. Adelaide, who ends up marrying Chang, is the one who's also very anxious about this union, and Sally is wanting to pull away. And it's kind of interesting later on, though, it seems to reverse because Addie and Chang have kind of built up an expectation, leaving themselves further to fall, whereas Sally and Ing have gone into it just thinking very much about all the complications and problems come out there. And I guess, as often happens in life, when you do it that way, they've kind of left room for themselves to be sort of pleasantly surprised.
This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and I'm talking with Surrey Arts Council actors Greg Matthews, who plays Chang Bunker, and Scott Carpenter, who plays his Siamese twin brother, Aang. Director Stan Bernstein is here too, and after this short break, we'll hear more from them about these fascinating twins who called Mount Airy home next when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Surrey Arts Council actors Greg Matthews and Scott Carpenter. Together, they play the world-famous Siamese twins, 19th-century brothers Chang and Aang Bunker, respectively. They're joined by director Stan Bernstein. Here's the second half of our conversation. Scott, which aspects of the play do you find most resonance with? And I guess if there's a critical scene or instance that you really want to communicate, what would that be?
As far as a scene between the brothers, there's a good scene where we're in bed thinking. Finally, Chang breaks the silence and says, you know, you don't have to play possum. And so we kind of talk about the whole idea about, you know, he's ready to make this move, and my character's just sort of saying, I don't know that I'm ready for this yet.
And the move is the marriage itself.
Yes. There's also constantly a question that's going to come up about us being separated through surgery, which, you know, the doctors had no idea what to do with us at that point.
Was it co-joined at the shoulder or the side?
Breastbone.
It's a band at the breastbone.
So the conversations that we have on both of these, let's make a move. One to get married, which Chang is all for and Aang is hesitant, and one to have surgery, which Chang is also excited about and I'm hesitant about.
Being co-joined, I mean, how do you maneuver that? Where are you joined physically and in the course of your portraying these brothers? And how does that impact, I guess, any host of things?
Well, there is a harness we've been using. We're kind of trying to I think, rework and repair right now, do something I think a little different this year. We've had to figure out, okay, how do we do the arms so we're not, you know, like causing physical pain to the other person or pressing a joint or the arms getting too tired.
As an actor, one thing you're constantly thinking about is where you are on stage to not block out any members of the audience. Normally, you're just thinking about yourself. For instance, you may have a conversation with someone that is to your left. Well, you're not going to face them because then the audience is only seeing your right side. Now with two of us, we're extra wide now. So how do we position ourselves on stage? I think the other thing is there are a few scenes where we get really mad at each other. And it's interesting having a fight with someone who's right there with you, you know, because normally you might get in a fight and people, you know, males, I guess, especially will get face to face, but then they'll pull back. We don't have that as an option. So it's very interesting being as close as we are. And I guess, again, being Americans, we like to have our space, whereas, you know, some other cultures are much more comfortable being very, very close.
In the final analysis, for me as a director, the real crux of the entire show, the whole show is all about the relationship of these two incredible men, and that all the things they had to look at, all the things they had to face, all the difficulties, was always grounded in the fact of this affection and love they have for each other and the care they have for each other. And yes, they want to be separated, and yes, they want to have their own lives, but doing so that would put the other one at risk was always a major factor. Their affection for each other is, I think, the very basis of the entire show and their lives.
Surrey Arts Council actors Greg Matthews, who plays Chang Bunker, Scott Carpenter, who plays Aang, and director Stan Bernstein. The play is The Wedding of the Siamese Twins by Burton Cohen. It opens Saturday, July 21st at 3:30 at the historic Earl Theater in downtown Mount Airy, and it'll run through Friday, July 27th. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Wow, what an amazing life story. And it all happened right here in the Piedmont, just a stone's throw from Mayberry. You'll find the Siamese Twins permanent exhibit located on the lower level of the Andy Griffith Playhouse, home of the Surrey Arts Council. They're open Monday through Friday from 9 to 5. The Wedding of the Siamese Twins theater performances coincide with the Bunker family reunion held annually during the last full weekend of July. This year, hundreds of descendants of Chang and Aang are expected to attend. Last year's reunion celebrated the 200th anniversary of the twins' birth. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. It's time to pack up the car once again, and this time we'll set out for another North Carolina treasure that happens to call the Piedmont home, right smack dab in the middle of our fair state, Asheboro, for a lesson in conversation, poetry, and humility. The North Carolina Zoo in Asheboro has a wonderful educational program that harnesses the power of the arts to engage people with nature. It's called The Poetry of Conservation, and this weekend, the zoo's poet-in-residence, family physician, and geriatrician Bill Griffin wraps up his tenure with two fabulous workshops for adults and kids. Earlier this morning, it was My Favorite Animal Is for kids 7 to 14, where they learn the techniques of writing a persona poem from their favorite animal's point of view. Coming up tomorrow, the adults get to roll up their sleeves and break out their ink quills during Bill's workshop titled Natural Poet, Poet Naturalist, from 10 a.m. to noon. You'll enlarge your perspective, inform your writing, and expand your impact as poets. Bill will be facilitating the discussion of several nature poems and guide participants through the process of composing nature poems of their own. Zoo admission is included in workshop registration fees, and you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Bill spoke with me by phone from his office in Asheboro at the North Carolina Zoo.
All the times I've visited the zoo, you know, I've been struck by how it not only gives you a sense of the exotic, but also brings you right here home to the Piedmont, you know, because of the setting and because the displays bring the, you know, wild animals close to you. I had a close encounter of the herpetologic kind yesterday evening. I was coming back from a program, and right outside the Sonora Desert exhibit, they have a wonderful rock garden, and this black and white streaked lizard jumped up on a rock, and I thought, I've never seen one of those before. He looks like he escaped from the Sonora Desert, and we were actually just looking him up online, and he actually is a southeastern fence lizard, so he's native, but he sure looked like he belonged in that rock garden.
I'll bet. Well, your background is in medicine, family physician, and geriatrician in rural North Carolina, talking the Elkin area. Talk about that entree for you into then the world of poetry.
I had some very inspiring teachers in high school and college, and so I kept up with reading over the years, but never really did much writing until about, I guess probably about 15 years ago, I took a workshop from Joseph Bethanty, who's now at Appalachian State, on reading contemporary poetry. And among the poets we read was A.R. Ammons, and I read the poem Hymn, which he uses a lot of scientific language to bring us not only close into the tiniest aspects of nature and creation, but also into the farthest reaches. And I thought, oh my gosh, science and poetry, they belong together.
You mentioned A.R. Ammons, and I can't think of a better kind of bridge between the world of science and poetry. Could you read a stanza or two from him?
He says, I know if I find you, I must go on out over the sea marshes and the Brant and Bay, over the canyons, crater lakes. And he keeps taking it out in the spiraling circles, you know, out into the atmosphere, out into space. And at the end he says, and I know if I find you, I will have to stay here with the separate leaves. So the sense I get from that is that to really discover the meaning in, within ourselves as well as the meaning of our place within our neighborhood, our habitat, our environment, it's not as if nature is out there and then where we live is something else. It's all part of one earth. Environmentalist from Africa, Baba Diouf, said, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We love only what we understand. We will understand only what we are taught. So the teaching aspect of us learning, you know, about the creatures and about the places they come from might inspire us to care for them to the point where we will conserve them, and by doing that, then we preserve ourselves.
Talk about how your art does bring about some innovative ways to communicate that message.
I think poetry can teach with a metaphor or with some really vivid image and slips right through the bars of your logical thinking and teach directly to your heart.
Well, you're no stranger to this world of bringing nature to the fore through poetry, and I'm referencing here the 2008 collaboration with your wife, Linda French Griffin, to create this book, Snake Den Ridge. That's out on March Street Press. I'm looking at this list of characters that you've sketched out here, squirrels, crayfish, salamanders. Could you pick one of those from the book and maybe treat us to one of those poems?
Okay, sure. I like to read you one of my favorites, Salamander. You know, in the Smokies, each watershed has its own distinct salamander species. So each one of these poems, the creature is actually speaking directly to the reader in first person. So this is Salamander. This is my gift to change. From Inadu Creek, I leave behind my frilly gills and climb the spire of blue-eyed grass. Having become a creature of air, bathing myself in dew, am I not still a creature of water? I invite you to discover in each of my family our variations, discern that every runnel, every spring, every palm-sized cup of moisture holds its lithe expectation, for this is my gift to you, to notice changes. I will let you lightly touch the welcome of my smoothness while I drink a little warmth from your hand. Now count the dapples down my length, measure the blush of my cheek. Then find, when you descend the eastern face of Snake Den Ridge, those subtle alterations my cousins are accumulating until finally they acquire a new name. And when you have returned me to my bed of blue bead lily, then touch a smooth place within yourself and carry with you into the world your own changes.
Boy, that's really nice, Bill, on so many levels. I love the image there of climbing the spires of the blue-eyed grass and then petting the smoothness of the skin, sharing that with the warmth of the hand, and then it comes back at the end to really forge that collaboration.
Well, I would hope that, you know, each creature in speaking something from within itself kind of touches the reader to find something within themselves that's maybe new or different or something they hadn't been aware of. And all the poems in the book also have a little backstory of an encounter behind them. The salamander we ran across as we were hiking the trail up to Clingman's Dome, and he had climbed up a spire of grass, and there he was with his red cheek. It was Jordan's red-cheeked salamander.
Great.
Which only exists in the Smokies.
Oh, hey, could you leave us with one more of your poems about nature? A short one about any of your favorites. That'd be great.
Sure. This is from a real bear encounter I had up at Cosby Knob Shelter, which is currently closed in the Smokies because there's too many bears up there. But if you hear me, it will be a nut falling from the buckeye. If you hear me, it will be a dry branch seeking earth. It will be slender fingers of mountain ash waving praises to the ridgeline sky. If you see me, it will be a shadow only one breath deeper than twilight. If you see me, it will be the twist of heart that skips a beat, the stark of pupils gone abruptly wide. I am mist that enfolds the laurel. I am stone that reclines beneath black hemlocks. I am a rumor at Madryn Bald, a tremor at Mount Gaio. Raven is mistaken. This ridge is mine. And if you hear me, it will be the rising chest of the mountain and its timeless, slow exhale. And if you hear me, it will only be because I didn't hear you first.
Oh, the menacing bear. That's great. I love how that pivots in that such a jazzy way with Raven is mistaken.
Yeah, Raven thinks he knows it all, but no, bear is boss.
My thanks to North Carolina Zoo Poet-in-Residence, Bill Griffin. On Saturday morning, July 14th, from 10 a.m. to noon, older teens and adults can enjoy Bill's workshop, Naturalist Poet, Poet Naturalist. Enlarge your perspective, inform your writing, expand your impact as poets, and enjoy a walk through one of the best zoos in the country right here in the Piedmont. You'll find links to more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford, and you're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. We've got amazing dance theater going on in Winston-Salem with Terpsichore. MUSEP presents live outdoor concerts like you won't believe going on in Greensboro's beautiful parks. Plus, it's an up-close and personal look at one Johann Sebastian Bach. 327 years after his birth, he's still rocking pianist Peter Kerhoff's world. We'll find out why just 60 seconds away with Kerhoff at the keyboard when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. And now for my favorite part of the show, it's a little old segment we like to call Understanding Classical Music with Kerhoff at the keyboard. Here's our good friend, pianist, and Wake Forest University professor of music, Peter Kerhoff.
Hello and welcome. Today we're going to be talking about really one of the greatest composers in all of music history, Johann Sebastian Bach. Some people think of Bach's music as potentially a little cold, a little mathematical, but I'm here to tell you otherwise. His music ranges in expressive content between the very serene to the sort of angry to rather dark and forlorn. In short, his music spans the range of human experience. But there's one particular aspect of Bach's music I want to talk about today, and that is a certain technique that he uses almost all the time. It's one of his favorite techniques, and that is the ability he had to combine multiple melodies together at the same time. We call that counterpoint. Here's what happens. He'll take a melody. And keep going with that melody and maybe take the same melody a little bit higher and add something to it. And sometimes he'll add two and three and four melodies at the same time. This is called counterpoint, and it's a particular kind of counterpoint we call imitative polyphony. And what that means is that each melody imitates each other. Here's the one melody. Imitated by, and so on. What I'd love to do is kind of take you into Bach's workshop right now and show you how this process works. Okay, let's say you're Bach and you're sitting down at the harpsichord. It's about 1720, and you start your workday by coming up with a melody like this one. Terrific tune. It's a little dancey melody. It's actually written in the style of an Irish jig. Well, some composers would be very happy with that, put a few chords underneath it, and so on, and that would be your piece. But Bach doesn't work that way. Here's what he does. He takes his melody and then gives it to the left hand down here. And those two melodies, the first one keeps going, the second one comes in here. And then he keeps going yet again, and he gives another melody, this time to your third hand, I suppose. That's what makes this music so miraculous. It's beautiful, it's fun to listen to, but it's astonishing when you look at the way it's put together. I'm just going to take those last few seconds I just played and just kind of peel some of the layers back. Here's the bottom melody. Here's melody number two on top of that. Beautiful. But then melody number three on top of those two. And the magic really happens. Well, Bach, being Bach, isn't content to just play even that complex of a game. What he'll do quite often is take these melodies now that we know very well, and he'll literally turn it upside down. In other words, instead of going the way we know it, down the scale, he takes virtually the same notes but turns it on its head, as if the music was just flipped on the music rack. So you see the way this turns into, and then the same process, that same melody upside down, down low. A third melody in the top. Kind of coalesce and end on the one note at the end. As you were listening, I bet you could tell, actually you probably couldn't, but it's in there, the upside down melody suddenly writes itself up and turns right side up, just like we knew from the beginning of the piece. So all these kind of musical techniques, games really, that Bach plays, would be just interesting and kind of cool if that's all they were. But what brings Bach's music into the realm of really the transcendent, and why we consider his music so great, and why we consider him perhaps one of the very greatest composers who've ever lived, is that all of these techniques, all of these ideas, all of these games that he plays are at the service of something greater. They're at the service of musical beauty. If the music weren't beautiful, we wouldn't care nearly so much about it.
Pianist and Wake Forest University Professor of Music, Peter Karoff, and you're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and it's time to dance. Backed by popular demand, Terpsichore Theater of Dance presents a dynamic, new, and expanded version of the many deaths of Edward Gorey and other moments of eccentricity. Renowned American author, enormous ballet fan, and macabre book illustrator Edward Gorey has a cult following of lovers of the bizarre in both art and literature. One of them is my next guest, dancer, choreographer, and Terpsichore artistic director Heather Malloy. Her penchant for the macabre was on full display during multiple productions of her wildly popular, untraditional ballet, Vampire, and you'll find it front and center in Many Deaths as well. The ballet runs through Saturday, July 14th, with a 2 o'clock matinee in the Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. Also on the program will be Heather's celebrated comic ballet, Couch Potatoes. She spoke with me by phone from her home in Asheville.
I grew up in Winston, and I was just one of those kids who had to perform. So whether it was dancing or acting or what it was going to be, I was going to be on stage. Because we would go to, say, like street scenes downtown, and my mother, she would turn around and not know where I was, and I'd be on stage like clogging with the band or whatever. We'd go to the movie theater, and if there was a little stage, I would beg if I can go up on stage and dance for the audience who was there to see the movie.
You were already dancing with North Carolina Dance Theater as a 17-year-old. Was it intimidating at that point? I mean, did you just fit right in? How was that transition?
I was at North Carolina School of the Arts before that, and Sal Aiello was the director of North Carolina Dance Theater at the time, and he saw me perform and hired as an apprentice, but one of the company members wound up retiring right after I was hired, so I literally, I think, spent 2 weeks as an apprentice and then became a full company member. And, I mean, it was definitely overwhelming. There was a lot of contemporary work that I had never really done before and a lot of partnering that I didn't have a lot of experience with. But it was interesting, you know, because I was there the last year in Winston-Salem, we made the big transition to Charlotte the following year. And by the end of that second year, just because so much transition had occurred, I was actually the senior, not in age, but in the length of time I'd been with the company, the senior female company member.
Wow.
So a lot of confidence came with that. And Sal saw something in me when I was young and gave me lots of opportunities. You know, I was already doing part of the work and soloist work that first year.
And you were going on to do choreography as a 19-year-old, but before we get there, what was your what did Sal give you in terms of your training and the big takeaway?
Sal is definitely the choreographer who inspired me the most. He would say to not just perform with your bodies, but to perform with your souls and to really express something to the audience. And he was a master at telling a story. And to me, I think that that's gotten lost in a lot of contemporary dance, that art of storytelling and the connection that that brings between the dancer and the audience. The new pas de deux that I've created for this upcoming show, Palm, is a simple pas de deux, but there's so much emotional content to it that I have audience members come up to me all the time telling me that it makes them cry, and they don't even know why. The emotional content for me and for the dancers is so strong and understood.
I'm always interested in the core elements. What are some of those for you that are just natural that a viewer might look forward to seeing in some of your work?
I think that my movement quality is very circular. Classical ballet is very straight up and down. There's not an intense amount of bending. You're not going down to the floor. And I like all of the levels. I like to get on the floor. I like to be just standing on the floor. Big lifts in my pas de deux. The rounder and fuller that the movement is, the better for me. And that's actually something that I picked up from Sal as well. I remember one of the things he said to me when I started choreographing was, make sure that there are level changes. It's so much more interesting for the audience and for the dancer when things aren't flat.
Almost like a three-dimensional character.
Right.
What was the initial vision behind Terpsichore? How did it come about?
To be able to build a body of work on dancers that I chose, and going to a town like Asheville that has a large summer scene where people are out and doing things, there's a lot of tourists, just seemed like a good place to start something like that.
For the non-dancer out there, I mean, folks should know that most major ballet companies out there across the country have a break during the summer, so you've got access to some of this great talent.
Exactly. I mean, your average professional dancer is sitting at home collecting unemployment from May until August and usually having to pay for classes to keep themselves in shape and just waiting for the new season to start.
The ground was fertile for this sort of vision, I guess. Well, let's dive into the many deaths of Edward Gorey and other moments of eccentricity. Edward Gorey was our American author and illustrator of macabre books. The third movement that I saw online, there was a YouTube link on your website. Really enjoyed that, and I was struck by that You've got the lighthearted kind of almost Laurel and Hardy kind of back and forth, which you know is extremely difficult to pull off. And then on top of that, some real athleticism represented in the movements and some beautiful gestures as well. Could you talk me through a sequence there and how it comes to you and how you play that out through rehearsal to bring it out?
Well, when I'm creating a ballet that does have a storyline, and I work one of two ways. I either completely outline the entire thing and then hand it to the composer, or in this instance, you know, we had little stories and images that we were going off of, and so we sat down together and we looked at the images, and I let them write the music first. So we had the music already. In that particular section we are talking about with the bicycle, they built that wonderful thing with the saw.
We're talking about Bill Carson?
Yes. It just lends itself so well to the bicycle, I thought. It was just perfect. But, you know, when you're working with a bicycle, it was a lot of collaboration with myself and the dancers. We would, you know, play around on what was possible dance-wise on a bike, you know, something I definitely hadn't done before. And I'm not that much of a daredevil myself. So it was a lot of, I think this might work. Can you guys try it?
That's the advantage of being the choreographer. You can pass that one off on somebody. Within that, as you mentioned, I mean, the ethereal sounds of the saw just somehow pair perfectly with what's going up on stage. And then you're adding these amazing lighting elements. There's almost like a silent film element going on and the costuming and the slow motion element. When did it dawn on you, hey, now would be a nice time to move into a slow motion segment?
Well, that happened because all the music sounded like that to me. Like, we got to that point in the choreography, and right at that moment where the first slow motion comes in, and she lets go of him and it falls to the floor, and then that music changed so quickly, and I was like, oh, it would be hilarious if we just did slow motion right here. And we worked for a long time to figure out how to get both of the dancers sort of moving at the same speed in slow motion, and then the hardest part is trying to ride the bike in slow motion.
So really, music is a big driver for you, Heather.
Oh, definitely. A lot of choreographers today choreograph without any music at all, and then to put music to it later and let the dancers sort of interpret how the two things should go together. And it's very trendy right now and works very well in many situations. As a dancer, I've worked that way a lot, but I think that as a choreographer, that would be extremely difficult for me. I feel that interpreting what's really there and what's really the heart of the music makes a big difference to me as far as knowing what to do movement-wise. I'm driven by the music and the story.
This year, the dancers are coming from all over the place. Maybe you could just highlight a few to give listeners a sense of, I mean, they're really getting a chance to see international quality talent right here in the Triad.
Definitely. The dancers are handpicked from companies across the country, and this summer we have a dancer, Kristen, who's coming from Le Grand Ballet Canadien in Montreal. We have Jonathan Powell, who is coming from Smuin Ballet in San Francisco. We have Michael Eaton coming from Kansas City Ballet. We have several dancers coming from Ballet Met in Columbus, Ohio, one of which is actually just moved here recently from England. And it's always hard. It's hard to pick because I see all this amazing talent and you have to make decisions as to who's going to work best together as well as who's going to work best for the particular pieces you're doing that year.
Terpsichore Theater of Dance Artistic Director Heather Malloy. She spoke with me by phone from her home in Asheville. The Many Deaths of Edward Gorey and Other Moments of Eccentricity is a hilarious, macabre, and touching evening of dance and theater you don't want to miss. It, along with Heather's celebrated comic ballet Couch Potatoes, will run through Saturday the 14th at the Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. And you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and if warm summer breezes, open blue skies, breathtaking sunsets, star-filled nights, all with glorious music ringing in the air sounds just too good to be true, I've got some news for you. Greensboro's Music for a Sunday Evening in the Park, MUSEP, is making it happen every Sunday through the end of August. You'll find some of the area's finest musicians performing in a gorgeous public park, a different park each week, and the best part is it's free. This summer, you'll hear everything from blues and R&B to classical, country, Latin, and more. The complete MUSEP performance calendar is posted on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And in the meantime, City Arts Music Director Jennifer Hance is here for another sneak peek at Music for a Sunday Evening in the Park 2012. The Philharmonia of Greensboro in Barber Park. Tell me about that location.
Barber Park is a really great facility we have here in Greensboro. It also has the Simpkins Pavilion there. We're really excited because we're going to be out at the amphitheater, which has a stage, and then it's an amphitheater bowl, which is a really beautiful setting. And a lot of people don't know about Barber Park. It really is a gem here in Greensboro, and we have a lot of people come out to hear that concert and see that beautiful facility.
The following weekend, on July 22nd, it's a 6 o'clock concert, and related to Eastern Music Festival, it's their EMF Fringe, relatively new element for EMF. I saw some great salsa band. You don't know what you're going to get, but the one thing you do get is always just really good music.
Yes, the EMF Fringe series is a really unique series that they have, and it's sort of off the beaten path. It's not their classical series. It's a more contemporary series, and we're actually going to have Soul Central performing for that concert. So we're really excited to have them back on the series as well.
Do you get a chance to go out and do a little A&R work for MUSEP?
I try to. I try to get out and hear different groups and see what's out there and what groups are here in our community, because we have such a huge, talented pool of musicians that I really like to get out there and be able to hear different groups and find groups that might be new and exciting for the series.
Do you find much difference between the recordings they submit and then hearing them live?
For the most part, no. Most groups, the recordings that they give and then their live performances are very similar. We're really very fortunate in Greensboro to have such a talented group of local musicians that we're able to feature. So we don't really have to go outside of Greensboro in the Triad area. We're able to find those groups here at home.
All right. And mixing it up, as always, on July 29th, we're going to go country with you. And tell me about these country artists, Caitlin Marks and Lisa Dames.
Caitlin Marks just got the best female artist in the Yes Weekly poll. She is a great country performer, and we're really excited to have her. People in Greensboro really enjoy hearing her perform.
So I'm strutting from a dusty country mile in his jet black Stetson hat. When he looked my way, he caught me smiling, and you can't come back from that. He was a rodeo Romeo all the way from head to toe, and man, he was making his move. Then he grabbed my hand, said, baby, let's dance, for I knew it, I was out of my shoes. And I said, cowboy, hang on just a minute, it ain't like me to jump right in it. Cool your boots, don't be in such a rush.
Lisa Dames is another really fantastic performer. She does traditional country and contemporary country. A lot of people associate her with Patsy Cline. So she's just a really fun performer.
Ooh, I get so sick of me. All my insecurities. You see me lose my mind. Watch my mood swing out of time. But somehow, you always look the other way. Can't figure out why you stay. I'm side. Well, you might be the only one who can love me like I am. How I'd leave me if I were you. I'd run as fast as I could the other way. That's what I'd do to get myself free.
My thanks to City Arts Music Director Jennifer Hance. Music for a Sunday Evening in the Park 2012 continues every Sunday through the end of August at nearly a dozen of Greensboro's fabulous public parks. This Sunday, it's the Philharmonia of Greensboro, starting up at 6:30 in beautiful Barber Park. You'll find links to the complete performance calendar on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. I sure hope you've enjoyed it. As always, I'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you're thinking on Facebook or Twitter, and you can always drop us a line at triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes on our website, along with details about all of the events we covered today. And again, that address is wfdd.org/triadarts. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.